This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the February 1987 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Bitch by Marion Zimmer Bradley. Darkness falling in Old Gandrin, in an unfamiliar quarter of the city. Lythanda, pilgrim adept of the Blue Star, alone, isolated and abandoned, far from her usual haunts, insofar as she had usual haunts, or could count on anything to recur and be ordinary in her far from ordinary life. To add to the general dismalness of the night, a light rain was falling, not heavy, but a drizzling persistence, not enough to soak anything, but enough to banish dryness, warmth, or comfort, and imbue everything with a miserable and pervasive dampness throughout. Although the streets of Old Gandrin were perhaps safer for an adept of the Blue Star than for an average citizen, they could hardly be said to be altogether safe for anyone after dark, and Lythanda had no more desire than anyone else to be attacked or robbed in the deserted fields in the graveyard district. She had come there considerably earlier in the day in search of certain herbs and ingredients for the making of spells. It was said to add to the efficacy of such ingredients that they grew or had been gathered in the shadow of the gallows. Lythanda was not altogether certain that she believed this, but if the clients of the magician believed it, she could hardly afford the luxury of flaunting this belief. After all, belief was a major ingredient that must be liberally stirred into every spell before it could work at all. Around her stretched a series of barren, open fields that had perhaps been last cultivated before the city walls were built. Here and there, the dim lights of occasional scattered dwellings in the rainy darkness. Even if the night had been clear, there would have been little moon. It was her business to know such things. The aforesaid gallows cast a long and wavering shadow almost to Lythanda's very feet. There was no sign anywhere of light, such as might have marked out an inn or any such place where one might find lodging. Beyond the gallows, a broken field stretched, lumpy and barren, with the uneven shapes of old and fallen gravestones. A deserted place, good perhaps for ghosts, but less salubrious for mortals, and Lythanda, in spite of a life prolonged by magic to the span of 3 ordinary lifetimes, still counted herself among the living and mortal. At this moment, a shadow crossed her path, and a not unfamiliar voice spoke, "Who goes there? Speak." "I am a minstrel, a magician, by the name of Lythanda," she said, and in answer came the most unexpected of words. "Greetings, fellow pilgrim. What do you on this lonely road at this God-forgotten hour?" If indeed there are gods, a question about which I entertain certain doubts, Lythanda observed calmly, "I would think it unlucky to call any place God-forgotten, in the fear that they might, in fact, forget it." "Even if there be no gods," replied the newcomer, a dark shadow on the path, "I should consider it unlucky to say so, for fear that if they do, in fact, exist, and I show bad manners by refusing to believe in them, they might retaliate by refusing to believe in me." Lysandra found the sound of that paradox sufficiently familiar to say, "Do I speak then to a fellow pilgrim?" "You do," replied the voice. "I am your fellow minstrel, Regine. We have debated these questions before, this time in the courts of the Blue Star to the sound of the lute. Do I guess rightly that we should together seek shelter, if only against damp and ghosts, for the exchange of songs?" "I am unfamiliar with these quarters," Lysander said, and while I have not yet encountered a ghost here or elsewhere, I observe somewhat similar precautions about ghosts as you against gods touching their existence or non-existence, in case I should have good reason for abandoning my disbelief. Now, in the darkness, Lysander could make out the lines of a voluminous magic robe cut like her own, deeply hooded, and in the folds of the magic robe's hood, the pale blue burning outline of a star, like the one that glowed between her own brows. She said, "If you know of any shelter against this possibly god-infested and ghost-harboring quarter, I will follow you to it." Regine's voice was a strong and resonant baritone, far deeper than the mellow and sexless contralto of Lysander's own, though perhaps equally musical. Across the back, where Lysander's lute was strung, Lysander could make out the outline of a chitarrón, an archaic but tuneful instrument almost as tall as the man who bore it. In fact, of all her fellow adepts of the Blue Star, there were few Lysander would have rather met on a dark night, for as far as she knew, she had no quarrel with Regine, and when they were fellow apprentices in the Temple of the Star, they had been friends, or as near to friends as any magician could come to friendship, which was to say that, at the least, they were not enemies. Lysander had had no true friends there, had dared have none, for alone, among all the pilgrim adepts from one end of time to the other, Lysander was a woman. Alone and in disguise, she had penetrated the secrets of the temple, and only after she bore the blue star between her brows had her disguise been exposed. She had paid the highest price ever for the power of a pilgrim adept, for when the truth was known, the master of the star had laid a doom upon her thus. "Be then forever what you have chosen to be," he said, "for on that day when your true sex shall be proclaimed aloud to any man save myself, on that day is your power at an end and your immunity from your fellows." So it had been since that day, a life of perpetual concealment, without relief, an eternal solitude with none but brief and superficial companionship, such as she might now find for a time with Regine. And now, as if to add to the general bleakness of the deserted and ghost-haunted quarter, the faint, mizzling rain began to come down harder into the darkness, blotting out even the semblance of any ordinary night. Lysander was not altogether sorry. The faint, drizzling rain of the past hours would create discomfort, but added nothing to the safety of the darkness. This sudden downpour would send any enterprising footpad or cut purse back to shelter, or, if desperate, would make it less likely that an assailant would identify the victim as a pilgrim adept. No sane thief would attempt to rob a magician of that stature, but in this darkness and rain, they might not be deterred. Regine tugged the hood of his magic robe tighter over his head, trying to rearrange the folds to protect the musical instrument. "Let us seek shelter," he said urgently. "I have not visited these parts for many years. I forget quite how many. But if my memory still serves me at all, there was once an old dame who kept a kind of alehouse, and when her public room was not too full, she would allow me to sleep on her floor by the fire. It was not the best shelter, but it was an inestimable improvement over the rain, and this is not such a night as I would willingly sleep under the stars, if there were any stars to sleep under, which there are not." "Lead on," Lysander said briefly. "I follow." This was better than she had hoped. She had little fear of women, and she had dwelt among the adepts of the Blue Star for 7 years of her apprenticeship without her true sex being even once suspected or exposed. A large public inn filled with men would have meant a night of endless vigilance in the company of one fellow pilgrim adept and an old woman, and if Regine's old acquaintance had been elderly in Regine's early days as a magician, she must be truly venerable now. She would have little to fear. She followed Regine's shadowy form before her, with little light except the pallid glimmer of the blue star that shone faintly between her brows, and the similar gleam escaping from beneath Regine's concealing hood. She tried to protect her lute from the worst of the rain, not easy to do because the spell that kept it dry was a taxing one, and when she had concentrated on keeping up with Regine in the darkness, she tended to lose sight of the spell. At worst, it was more important that the lute be kept dry than that her own feet and body be sheltered from rain. They would dry without harm, and the lute would not. After what seemed a long time of darkness and rain, stumbling on uneven ground broken with what might have been old sunken gravestones, Lythanda made out the dim lights of a cottage, an old and tumble-down building with sagging stone walls and a door of plank so old, split and broken, that the firelight streamed out between them, sheltering out of the wind, which came around the corner of the building with howling violence. Lythanda hugged her magic robe close to her shoulders and thought that even if this place was deserted and the haunt of ghosts or even ghouls, she would have shelter this night from the rain. From inside came the sound of a cracked and quavering voice. Then the door was pulled open from inside, and a stooped old woman stood in the firelight. She was dressed in faded rags and tatters, a much patched shawl over her bent shoulders being almost more patched than shawl, her face so wrinkled and drawn that Lythanda, who was herself immensely old, could not even begin to guess her age. "Dame Laura," cried Regine, "I rejoice to see that you still dwell in this world. I have brought a friend to beg shelter at your fire this night. Had you no longer dwelled here, I was prepared to spend this wild night begging shelter of some poor ghost in his tomb." Dame Laura chuckled, a sound that seemed to Lythanda so wild and humorless that it was hardly human. "Ah, Regine, my friend, there is better shelter than that for you. Better even if this were no better than a tomb. I would deny shelter neither to the living nor the dead on such a night as this. Come inside, dry yourselves by the fire there." She gestured them to the hearth, where a large rug covered the cold stone, and stretched out on the stone lay two large dogs, hairy and shaggy, sound asleep with their noses to the fire. Regine shoved one, the nearer dog, black and shaggy, with his foot, and the animal made a sleepy, grumbling sound without waking and scooted a little to one side to make room for Regine to shed the magic robe and hang it over a rickety stool that stood at the edge of the hearth rug. After a moment, Lythanda did the same, boosting another stool to the fireside and hauling off the half-drenched magic robe. Regine sat between the dogs, stretching his stockinged feet to the fire, and drew the chitarrón to himself, tuning the instrument to make certain it had taken no harm. Lythanda pulled off her boots, stretching her narrow feet to the fire. The smaller of the two dogs, a tan and shaggy, long-haired bitch, crowded against her, but the animal was warm and friendly, and after all, it had a better right to the fire than she did. Dame Laura pulled a large cauldron from its crane over the fire and asked, "May I offer ye some supper? And will ye play me a tune on your lutes?" "Pleasure, muttered Regine, and began to play an old ballad of the countryside. Lysander discovered that the strings of her lute were soaked with the rain, but she had spare lengths of gut stowed in the many pockets of the magic robe. She fumbled in them and set about mending and replacing the strings. The old woman scooped a ladleful of stew into each of a couple of coarsely carved wood bowls and held one bowl out to Lysander. It smelled delicious, and Lysander, seeing that Regine was looking into the fire and not at her, ventured a couple of bites. One of the many vows fencing the power of a pilgrim adept was that she might neither be seen to eat nor drink in the sight of any man, but the vows did not apply to women, and Regine was not looking at her. She chose to apply the prohibition quite literally and hastily. While Regine was bent over his lute and tuning it, she managed to get down a good part of the stew, though when he raised his eyes and asked her to play, she at once left off eating. "No, you play. I am not familiar with the sound of the chitarrón," she asked. He seemed gratified by the request and again bent his face over the lute, so that Lysander managed to finish the stew. After that, Lysander played and sang, but soon began to feel sleepy close to the fire, covered herself with the magic robe, which also covered the dogs, and tumbled quickly into sleep. Her last awareness was of the strong smell of wet dog and of Regine storing on the rug beside her. When she woke, she was aware of the firelight and silence. She looked up and saw no sign of Regine, but only the long dog stretched out on the hearth. Then, about to stretch out, she looked at her hand, and her hand was not there. Only a hairy, tan paw extended towards the fire. Something was wrong with her perspective. She seemed closer to the fire than before. She sprang up, trying to cry out, and heard only a long, lugubrious howl. At that sound, the other dog sprang up, barking wildly, and above the dog's low, hairy forehead, she saw a pale gleam of blue in the shape of a star. She recognized the other dog. It was Regine, and she herself had somehow been transformed into the bitch lying beside her on the rug. Dame Laura still crouched over her cauldron, muttering in some unknown language. Or was it only that Lysander could no longer understand human speech? Lysander rushed in panic for the door on all fours, followed by the other dog, who was Regine. Outside it had stopped raining, and by a curious distorted moonlight she raced through the deserted land, stumbling over gravestones, Regine racing after her. Transformed by sorcery, and since I have become a bitch, Regine will know I am a woman, she thought, and wondered why she was thinking about that, trapped in animal form. She could not even speak a spell to break the enchantment. Or was this the kind of spell that lasted only until sunrise or moonset? But why had nothing warned her of magic in action? The blue star should have warned her of the presence of sorcery. Yet, in all justice, she realized that the unaccustomed warmth, after a cold soaking, the hot food, and her attempt to eat unobserved, had taken her mind from any thought of hostile magic. She wondered for a moment if Regine had betrayed her. No, he himself was victim of the same magic. They had blundered together into the spell. Regine was still racing away in panic. Lysander tried to call out to him, but heard only a curious whining growl and desisted almost at once. Can this be only a dream? Can it be that I am still lying before the fire in the witch's cottage, dreaming this? she wondered. But the chill of the graveyard was penetrating the pads on her paws, and there was no change in the dream's surroundings, so this was no dream, but some vicious, sorcerous reality, and she, as well as Regine, was trapped inside it. Regine, or rather the dog in whose consciousness Regine now dwelt, stopped his headlong rush and turned back towards her, whining pitifully and circling around, barking softly. Then he stopped and whimpered, stretching himself out as if he were trying to crawl with shame into the very ground. Lythanda's thoughts were now wholly concerned with the spell into which she had blundered and how she could get out of this. There were magical herbs that grew in the shadow of the gallows. Perhaps she could find one that would break the spell. The problem was that she had no particular belief in the efficacy of that kind of spell. Nevertheless, under these circumstances, she found her disbelief eroding away. It evidently made a difference which side of the spell you were on. She looked round, trying to orient herself from the peculiar perspective of a dog's vision. Her eyesight was excellent, but everything seemed very high up, and she was afraid of stumbling over the gravestones. The long shadow of the gallows still dominated the wasteland, and she went closer. She smelled the faint bitterness and found the herb for which she was looking, the threefold shiny leaf and pale berry, colorless by moonlight, although by normal day and in normal sight, it might have been pale green. She bent to nibble the herb. She knew from experience that it was faintly bitter, like most herbs, but when her sharp dog's teeth bruised the leaf, it was intense, nauseating, releasing a harsh, violent oil that flooded her with such sickness that she reflexively spat it out. So much for that. Dogs didn't eat herbs. She should have remembered that. They sometimes ate grass when they were sick, but evidently sorcery did not qualify as an illness. She tried to bite at the ordinary grass to take the taste of the herb out of her mouth. The grass tasted bland and coarse, like tasteless lettuce. What next? She recalled an ancient superstition. If she circled 7 times clockwise round the gallows, or was it counterclockwise? Well, she would try it 7 times clockwise, and if that had no effect, she would try it 7 times counterclockwise, and if that had no effect, well, she would have to think of something else. But Regine, to her amazement, she saw that the larger dog was bounding around the gallows and actually frisking his tail, had already thought of that. She followed, but nothing happened. As she began her 8th circumambulation of the gallows, she stopped and reversed the direction. But nothing happened. We could keep this up all night. Dogs probably would. She scowled. It distorted her vision oddly, because her hairy forehead was at such an odd angle to her eyes, and flung herself down on the grass to think of any other possibility. There must be something else that she could try. She turned around to look for Dame Laura's cottage. If she went back and confronted the hag, threatened to tear out her throat, the damnable hag would probably consent to take off her spell. But she could not see the smallest glimmer of light from the witch's fire. She thought, but was not sure, that she could see the outline of the cottage, but it was entirely dark. The hag must have doused her fires and gone to bed, as if the enchanting of 2 wizards were just part of a good night's work. In a rage, Lysandra thought, let me get my hands, my paws, on her, and if I don't make it the worst night's work she ever did, my name is not Lysandra. Reversing her direction, she went bounding over uneven grass and gravestones towards the faraway dark outline of the cottage. Then she stopped. Her acutely keen hearing in dog form sensed a movement on the grass not too far away. She stopped to allow Regine to come up with her. She could hear him panting with his tongue hanging out. The movement advanced, and a shadow loomed over her, a robed Ur. A wizard? No, some kind of priest. His sacred staff was extended. Regine jumped up and gripped the staff between his teeth. The priest cried out in surprise as the staff clattered to the gravestones. As Lythanda touched it, she felt a shudder run through her limbs, and stretching rose easily to her feet. The priest was gasping, reaching for his staff. 1,000 pardons, Regine said easily, and as many thanks, for you have released us from an evil enchantment. The priest gathered up his staff with an exclamation of astonishment. Regine was wearing a loose, whitish, pajama-like garment. Lythanda was dressed in leather tunic and breeches, and her feet were bare and cut on the loose stones and gravestones. Limping, she bowed to the priest, saying gravely, "Lythanda thanks you, priest." My pleasure to be of service, said the priest uneasily. But tell me, how and when did all this happen? I did not know that this deserted quarter was subject to enchantments. Obviously, we did not either, said Lythanda. And Regine added, I thought I was visiting an old friend. I think now it must have been a ghost or evil friend in her shape. An old friend living hereabouts? Asked the priest. But, my good man, no one dwells in this quarter. Dame Laura's cottage, Regine said, and I must return there. But, my good fellow, the priest began to argue. Then, at Regine's grim stare, subsided and followed him as he set out towards the outline of the cottage. It is fortunate that I came along. I was going out to greet the sun from that hill yonder. I visit this necropolis only once a year, on the anniversary of the death of my old great aunt. I come to say a prayer for her, for she was good to me in her own way, though I fear she was a wicked woman. This was that selfsame Dame Laura, your companion, claims to have seen. Claims be damned, said Lythanda. Dame Laura sheltered us by her fire last night and fed us with a stew that led to my enchantment. But, my good man, that is simply impossible, said the priest, and followed them as they approached the dark line of the cottage. It was beginning to get light now, and she could clearly make out the familiar line of the odd peaked roof, though no light showed through the dilapidated planks of the door. Regine banged on the door, then shouted, "Silence!" Then he shoved the door open. Inside, by the growing light, they could clearly see that the cabin was empty. No fire, no dogs, no rug where the dogs had lain, only bare stone flooring, and lying on the floor, two magic robes, Lythanda's lute and the broken-stringed chitaron. I suppose we should be glad for this, said Lythanda, picking up the lute. She shrugged the magic robe around her shoulders and felt less vulnerable, though the priest, no more than any other man, could have identified her lean, breastless figure as that of a woman. The spare strings of the lute were untouched in her pocket, the packet still sealed, and yet she remembered mending and restringing the lute while she sat between the dogs on the hearth rug. Regine, dressing slowly in his own magic robe, looked angry, the blue star gleaming between his scowling brows. He went to the hearth where the great cauldron still hung on its crane. Inside, The cauldron was cold and empty, yet Lysander could still, in memory, taste the stew she had eaten. "I told you so," said the priest with a smug, injured air. "Dame Lura died on yonder gallows 50 years ago this night." Lysander turned her back on the empty cottage and began to walk swiftly away. She could clearly see now in the frost the footprints of two dogs running this way, then abruptly her own human footprints and Regine's coming to the cottage. After a moment, Regine caught up with her. "I gave the priest 2 silver pieces, he said. "Even though he disenchanted us by accident, I am grateful." Lysander fumbled in her pockets and handed him a silver coin. "I will share the fee," she said. "Even so, we were lucky," Regine said. "We encountered no bitches. I have no sons, and if I did, they might well be sons of bitches, but I would prefer that they be so metaphorically rather than literally, if you take my meaning." So he had not even noticed, or if he had thought Lysander assumed the other dog's shape out of default. "If I had had a son," Lysander said, trying to make her voice casual, "I would prefer that he be not a cur. Nevertheless, Regine, I knew when we dwelt in the temple of the blue star that you were a real son of a bitch, and now I can prove it." The sun was coming up. Regine looked at her and laughed. He said, "Let's find a tavern and a pot of ale. I wish I knew what was in that stew." Lysander said, "I'm sure we're better off not knowing." "Let's go," said Regine. "Last one to the city gates is a dirty dog." "Right," said Lysander, thinking, "that's one expression I'll never use again." We continue with a story from the January 1987 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is The Million Dollar Wound by Dean Whitlock. "Hell," Billy said, "it's only a year. I can make it through a year." He killed his beer and threw the can at the box of empties. "Besides, if I'm lucky, I'll get the million dollar wound." He grinned at Frank and me, expecting agreement. We looked at each other and looked back, faces blank. He looked amazed. "Shit, what the hell do they teach you in medic school? The million dollar wound is your ticket home. A clean shot through a thigh muscle. A little blood, a little hurt. Keep it clean and it heals right up. But first, they give you a purple heart and send you stateside. My grandfather got one in Vietnam. He was drafted, too, same as us." He popped open another warm beer, drank the suds off the top, and grimaced. "This Pedro beer is real piss." Frank and I finished ours and took more. "Help if it was cold," Frank said. He went back to his book, and I put a couple of cans in the freezer with the blood. "Shit, nothing would help this crap," Billy replied, but he kept drinking it. Billy was the kid of the unit, or looked it. Small, blonde, big grin, bright eyes. He took a lot of crap in boot camp and learned to give it back. Drink hard, swear hard, punch a few shoulders to show you're tough. He was a draftee, too, and that didn't help in a platoon full of volunteers. When our medic unit got attached to his group, he started hanging out with us off-duty. We drank a lot of that warm Bolivian beer together. Frank and I weren't really draftees. Frank was pre-med, as he used to call it. He couldn't afford college, so he was getting his training the hard way. He was thin and dark, with blue growth on his chin 2 minutes after shaving, and he spent a lot of time reading textbooks. I was a CO. I came out of college with an English degree and a choice of immediate employment: war plant, nuke plant, medic, or jail. No Canadian refuge this war. I took medic, I guess, because I thought somebody had to balance the killing. Anyway, We weren't volunteers, and that suited Billy. We got to be friends, even.
So Grandpa got out whole? Frank said.
Yeah, spent the rest of his tour in Germany, drinking real beer.
How long was he in Nam?
Before he got the million-dollar wound, I mean.
6 months,
Billy laughed. Hell, he was halfway home anyway, wasn't he? I got 11 months and 3 days to go, and I haven't even been shot at.
They had shorter months in Nam, I said.
What do you mean?
R&R counted, I told him. When Gramps went down to Saigon for a week, it was still combat time. He could go for a month to Tahiti, and it was still part of the year.
Shit! Billy threw his can at the box. Figures the Army would nix that one. I gotta spend 365 days on the line.
Frank nodded.
And we've got 730 each.
With 10 sick days, I added.
Shit, and you guys can't even shoot back.
Patrol was hard work. We were northeast of La Paz in the foothills near the Mamoré. The terrain was rough and broken, high fields separated by forest and deep ravines. It was hot during the day, cool at night. It rained a lot for weeks and then baked for weeks. The people lived in small houses, raised potatoes, minced copper and tin, and soon enough they started shooting at us. Sometimes it was guerrillas and sometimes it was coke farmers, but the bullets did the same thing. Billy and his unit kept shooting back, and Frank and I cleaned up after them. We were in a quiet area, at least. Short bursts of fire, a few flesh wounds, mostly Band-Aid stuff. One guy tripped, rolled down a hill, and broke his leg. Frank and I slapped on the plaster and carried the dumb ox 4 miles up to a flat place where a chopper could land. The first bad one stepped on a blender. That's a spring-mounted trap that closes on your leg and shreds it from the hip down. He screamed, and somebody else shouted, "Medic!" And Frank and I went running up to the head of the column. There was a lot of blood and a lot of pain, and the rest of the unit stood around watching with sick looks while 4 of them held him down and pried the damn thing open. Then the sergeant shouted them into a defensive formation, and Frank and I tried to stop the bleeding. Frank got real businesslike, pumping in morphine and plugging holes like it was a plastic dummy in training. He had good hands, Frank. He would have made a good surgeon. I just poured on gel and handed him staples and tried not to throw up. We developed that into a pattern. Frank played doctor and I played nurse and the unit played soldier. Frank took it real seriously, treated each man like he was the only patient we had. Then the fighting got serious, and 2 weeks later, with 9 months and 13 days to go, Billy got his million-dollar wound. Frank was doctoring at the other end of the line, so I hauled my kit over to Billy. What could I say? He was lying there with a dark stain spreading down his pants and a big grin on his face. I cut the cloth away and wiped off the blood. There was a pair of holes in his thigh, the front one small and tidy, the back one big and ragged. But it had missed the bone and the artery, and he knew it.
Gramps would be proud, I told him. Do you need morphine?
His smile was getting strained.
He nodded. Might as well celebrate. I pumped him up and sprayed on some gel, and we sent him off with the rest of the wounded.
3 weeks later, he was back with a purple heart and a pair of tiny scars on his head. No limp, no pain, no Germany, and no more sick days. He had 9 months and 3 days left. He told us a little bit about it one evening over some beers. They took some muscle and skin from my other leg and stuck it in the hole. Then they soaked me in some kind of soup, like that shit you guys are always spraying around, and shined these big blue lights on my leg.
Frank was real interested. What did they give you to eat?
Mostly crap and pills, all the time pills, but no morphine, not even aspirin. Bastards.
Did they use massage?
Shit, no. They made me lift weights with my foot.
What did it feel like under the lights?
Hot, I guess.
He took another drink.
Mostly it just hurt. Can't feel a damn thing now, though. He rubbed his leg as though he wanted it to hurt. Shit, it's like it never happened. I handed him another can. Looks like you'll have to go for the $2 million wound. He laughed sharply. Right. Next time I'll ask the Pedros to blow my whole leg off. Then the army can send me home to grow a new one. We all laughed a little and started making jokes about the wrong size leg and what else they could grow back. It wasn't all that funny, but all we could do about it was laugh. The soldier who'd stepped on the blender came back a little later, too, and more of the wounded, the once wounded. They went back out on patrol, and they were a lot more careful. And Frank and I got to work on some of them again. Billy took his second hit about a month later, just shy of 7 months to go. I remember because Frank and I had scraped the big red crosses off our helmets the night before. Frank started carrying a rifle about then, too. The guerrillas had started shooting medics. Maybe they recognized all the rebuilt GIs and thought we were doing the fixing. What did we know? We just poured on gel, pumped them up, and tried to keep them alive until the chopper came. We had moved further to the northeast, still near the river, where the hills were less rugged and ravines more forested. We started using napalm on the guerrillas, too, and they started using it back, probably our own stuff. They didn't have planes and choppers to drop it from, so they canned it and lobbed it in with skeet throwers. The guys called them frisbees. If you were good, you could hit them in the air, but they splattered fire on anything underneath. If you let them hit, they burned less territory. Billy was at the front of the line. God knows why, because he never volunteered for that kind of duty. The Pedros were above us and started firing down on the trail. Luckily, they started shooting as soon as they saw the lead man. Lucky for the rest of us, at least. Billy hit the bushes and started firing back, while the rest of us went into the trees and gave cover. Then they lobbed in the napalm, two frisbees, maybe three. They put a pool of fire right on Billy. We heard him screaming, and then he came running out, the right side of his body and both boots on fire. You can't stamp out napalm. It sticks to you. We had special blankets and a spray that foamed, and we smothered Billy as fast as we could. His clothes saved most of him from real damage, but his hands weren't covered, and neither was his face. His right hand was charred to the bone and three fingers gone. His right cheek started to flake away, and the ear, too, and he had third-degree burns from his neck up into his hair. When we took his helmet off, part of his scalp came with it. There wasn't much we could do but give him morphine, cover him with gel, and get him out fast. He kept his eyes shut. They were both still there, thank God, and held his left hand in a fist up under his mouth, muttering to himself and crying. I thought he was praying at first, but he got louder whenever we jolted the stretcher or touched him. I could hear him moaning, "Oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit," over and over again. Even Frank was shaken. Billy was back in 3 months with new pink skin, and a hand that clicked a little when he moved his thumb in a certain way, and white hair in a patch on the right side of his head, and he still had 7 months to go. He never talked about the hospital this time, and Frank didn't ask him. We shared a lot more beer and a bottle of vodka Billy had smuggled back, and talked about sports and video and women and everything but war. But Billy kept rubbing his hand through the patch of soft white hair and clicking his thumb. And finally, after one long time of silence and clicking and Frank turning pages, he seemed to notice his thumb. He stared at his hand curiously and said, "What do you think they can't fix? I mean, what if the suckers had burned off both my legs and my balls, too? Would I be stuck in a wheelchair for the rest of my life, or would I walk around clicking with a little pump in my pocket for getting it up?" I don't know, Frank said. We've seen a lot of guys come back. So who doesn't come back? I mean, what the hell does it take to get out of this? I shook my head and offered him the bottle, but he didn't see it. He answered himself, I'll tell you what, you gotta be a goddamn vegetable, that's what. I mean, you really gotta be maimed, 'cause they sure aren't gonna let a little mechanical damage get in the way. I mean, shit, that's just a little pain. Just kiss it, make it better. Then he took the bottle. Later that night, Frank and I had to put him to bed. Billy was real careful for 3 months. He walked slowly, in camp and on patrol. His eyes moved left to right all the time, scanning. He got thin. Frank and I watched him go from being tense to being scared. It became part of him. He talked and moved and even told jokes scared. He acted calm, but it was fatalism. Anyway, it was Frank who got hit next, just a month after Billy got back. It was a dumb thing, even for a war. The unit had a bunch of Pedros pinned down in a farmhouse, waiting for a chopper to come up and douse them. We were back a ways in some trees, tending to the casualties. I was putting band-aids on a couple of guys who'd gotten nicked, and Frank was trying to stop all the blood from running out of another guy who'd been gut-shot. Suddenly, somebody was shooting at us. The two walking wounded started shooting back, and things got real hot. There wasn't much I could do, so I crawled over to Frank and started working on the other guy with him. Frank kept his usual calm, plugging and stapling, and we were making headway on his stomach when the Pedros shot him in the leg. The GI was past feeling, but Frank got mad. He handed me the stapler and picked up his gun and started shooting back. The extra firepower seemed to help because it got real quiet. Then, 4 Pedros came out of the woods with bayonets and knives. They got one of the GIs before he even heard them, but Frank and the other guy started firing. 2 of them went down right then, but the other 2 took out the second GI and kept coming. Frank kept pulling the trigger, and they kept coming, but then one dropped, and the last one made a flying lunge and ended up on his face at Frank's teeth with the top of his head open and his gun sticking up out of Frank's foot. The bayonet went straight through 6 inches into the dirt. Frank looked down at his foot and up at me. He put down his own gun, wiped his face, and pulled the other gun up out of his foot. Then he sat down and started treating himself for shock. You know, he said, that was really dumb. I didn't know if he meant the Pedros or his foot. I went over to the first GI and started patching. Billy and some of the other guys showed up just then, and I felt a little better. Billy knelt by Frank and helped him cut the boot away. They took a look at the foot, and Billy squeezed his shoulder. You'll be back in a month, Frank, he said. It was only 3 weeks. Frank said they were getting better at it. He also said there was one thing they hadn't worked out, anesthetic. They couldn't give you too much because it slowed the healing. It was a long 3 weeks for him. He smuggled in some more vodka, though, and brought some news from the States. No more draft, he told us. You're shitting me, Billy said. He clicked his thumb, a nervous habit now. No, they said they don't need it anymore. The volunteers are enough. They can't be getting that many, I said. Half my graduating class had been against the war. Frank shook his head. They don't need as many, he said. All they have to do is keep the old ones running. You sound like a mechanic. They gave me a tour of the surgery. They move him in, they move him out. There's not much they can't fix. Billy nodded, his eyes hard. Then he had a thought, and he smiled. It looked strange after all that time. Wait a minute, he said. What about us suckers that got drafted already? They're going to have to send us home, aren't they? Frank laughed. Don't bet on it, Billy boy. You've got miles of tread left. He laughed again, but it was pretty flat. One thing I learned from Frank getting shot. As far as they were concerned, I was a gringo, and I had no right to be there. I agreed with them, but I wasn't leaving in a box if I could help it. Nonviolence doesn't preclude self-defense, not when the guy who wants to kill you won't stop to hear your side of it. That's what I told myself, at least. I picked up a 45 in exchange for some pure green alcohol, practiced a few hours, and started carrying it on patrol. It made me feel a little safer, and it wasn't as blatant as a rifle. Meanwhile, Billy lets his hopes get up about getting home. The news came about the draft, and he started waiting for the word. He was still waiting a month later when the Pedros got him again. It was short and dirty, a quick burst of fire from the bushes. Then the Pedros took off. The squad went after them and left Frank and me with Billy in the middle of the trail. It was a bad wound. They'd opened his stomach with a shredder and left it and half his intestines lying out on the ground with hundreds of little needles stuck in them. Billy was conscious, beyond pain, watching the organs move as though they were the most interesting thing in the world. I called for a chopper. Then we clamped the big veins and arteries, pulled out all the needles we could see, poured in some gel, and poured the entrails in with it to move him. Billy stayed awake, watching, and finally I had to walk up the trail to get away from his eyes. When I looked back, Frank had his rifle up against Billy's head. I shouted, "Frank!" and ran back towards him. He looked up at me, and I stopped, kicking up dust that drifted over him and Billy. "Frank, what the hell are you doing?" He looked down at Billy and then back at me. He kept the gun aimed at the white patch in Billy's hair. "Frank!" He cleared his throat, and I waited, sweating. The sun glared. Finally, he said, "He asked me to do it." I looked at Billy. His eyes were closed. "And you were going to?" He nodded. "That's murder," he laughed. "You can't murder a dead man. He's not dead." He wasn't. I could see him breathing. Frank shrugged. "Brain death. That's the only thing that will kill him. That's why he asked me." "Frank, a doctor's got to save lives, not take them. They don't have the right to make that decision." "How many times do I have to save them?" But he put down his gun. The chopper came and took Billy away, and we went back to base. The next day, the major called me in on the floor to ask what had happened out there. Apparently, Frank had come in yelling about zombies and throwing his textbooks at anyone with brass. Somewhere in there, he threatened to shoot every wounded soldier on the front. They sent him off, and I heard later that they had him in an institution stateside, mentally incompetent. I stayed in the woods with the squad, and eventually Billy came back. He was down to 4 months, but he looked like he wasn't going to make it. They all looked like that now, even the lucky ones who'd never been hit. Hell, most of them were volunteers. They'd come in ready to give their lives for their country. Well, they'd done that, and then some. 2 weeks later, Billy got it again, another gut wound. I plugged up the holes in his new stomach and looked at the piece of Teflon tubing, or whatever it was, that ran out of it. My own stomach twisted. The plastic was worse than blood. His eyes were closed, and he was breathing unevenly. I'd done all I could with my kit, so I took his hand and held it. I thought he was out, but he opened his eyes and looked at me. He squeezed my hand, and I felt his thumb click in my palm. "How many times are you going to let them kill me?" he said. Then he went out for good. I checked for a pulse, but it was gone. I closed his eyes and sat back on my heels and thought about how many times I'd sent him off on the chopper, and how many times he'd come back. And then I remembered that he still had 3 months and 2 weeks to go. That's when I took out the 45 and shot him in the head. It's a big bullet, big enough to break your arm, with a near miss. No one asked any questions. I waited for him to come back. I waited 3 months before I began to believe that Frank was right, and I began to see more head wounds, always in the worst guys, the guys like Billy, who'd been hit the most, the guys who had close buddies who'd helped them out. Getting out was all they talked about anymore. I did it for one other GI. Like Billy, he asked me to, and I got a letter from Frank with a clipping about a peace rally. He was out of the institution and working for some vet agency, writing letters to Congress and to newspapers. He said it was hard because there was no draft, so there was no pressure on anyone at home to save their own butts. But he said it was working. They were going to change things. I hope to God he's right. I hope they change the regs tomorrow or end the war so these guys really could get out. Frank's the kind of guy who could make it happen. Me, I'll do what I can here. I've still got 6 months to go, 6 real months. I figure I could still help out a lot of these guys. And you do help out. When they ask you, you do it. They've got a name for it now. They call it the $1 million wound. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.